Yes, ma'am. The elevator that rose from the common lobby and meeting rooms up to the offices glittered like spun diamonds set in steel, and was big enough to seat dinner for four. It recognized them as they stepped in, and began its careful rise through the levels. Outside the windows of the common areas, the Binnenhof seemed to sink, and the huge anthill of buildings that was The Hague spread out under a perfect blue sky. It was springtime, and the snow that had touched the city since December was finally gone. The pigeons swirled up from the streets far below. There were 30 billion people on the planet, but they would never crowd out the pigeons. "They're all fucking men," she said. "Excuse me?" Soren said. "The generals, they're all fucking men." "I thought Souther was the only..." "I don't mean that they all fuck men. I mean they're all men, the fuckers. How long has it been since a woman was in charge of the armed forces? Not since I came here. So instead we wind up with another example of what happens to policy when there's too much testosterone in the room. That reminds me. Get in touch with Annette Rabir in infrastructure. I don't trust Nguyen. If traffic starts going up between him and anyone in the General Assembly, I want to know it." Soren cleared his throat. "Excuse me, ma'am. Did you just instruct me to spy on Admiral Nguyen?" "No, I just asked for a comprehensive audit of all network traffic. And I don't give a fuck about any results besides Nguyen's office." "Of course, my mistake." The elevator rose past the windows, past the view of the city, and into the dark shaft of the private office levels. Avasarala cracked her knuckles. "Just in case, though," she said. "Do it on your own initiative." "Yes, ma'am. That was my thought, too." To those who knew Avasarala only by reputation, her office was deceptively unassuming. It was on the east side of the building, where the lower-ranked officials usually started out. She had a window looking out over the city, but not a corner. The video screen that took up most of the southern wall was left off when it wasn't in active use, leaving it matte black. The other walls were scuffed bamboo paneling. The carpet was industrially short and patterned to hide stains. The only decorations were a small shrine with a clay sculpture of the Gautama Buddha beside the desk, and a cut crystal vase with the flowers that her husband Arjun sent every Thursday. The place smelled like fresh blooms and old pipe smoke, though Avasarala had never smoked there and didn't know anyone who had. She walked to the window. Beneath her, the city spread out in vast concrete and ancient stone. In the darkening sky, Venus burned. In the 12 years she had been at this desk, in this room, everything had changed. The alliance between Earth and its upstart brother had been an eternal, unshakable thing once. The belt had been an annoyance and a haven for tiny cells of renegades and troublemakers, as likely to die of a ship malfunction as to be called to justice. Humanity had been alone in the universe. And then the secret discovery that Phoebe, idiosyncratic moon of Saturn, had been an alien weapon, launched at Earth when life here was hardly more than an interesting idea wrapped in a lipid bilayer. How could anything be the same after that? And yet it was. Yes, Earth and Mars were still unsure whether they were permanent allies or deadly enemies. Yes, the OPA, Hezbollah of the Vacuum, was on its way to being a real political force in the outer planets. Yes, the thing that had been meant to reshape the primitive biosphere of Earth had instead ridden a rogue asteroid down into the clouds of Venus and started doing no one knew what. But the spring still came. The election cycle still rose and fell. The evening star still lit the indigo heavens, outshining even the greatest cities of Earth. Other days, she found that reassuring. "Mr. Ehrenreich," Soren said. Avasarala turned to the dead screen on her wall as it came to life. Sadavir Ehrenreich was darker skinned than she was, his face round and soft. It would have been in place anywhere in the Punjab, but his voice affected the cool, analytic amusement of Britain. He wore a dark suit and a smart, narrow tie. Wherever he was, it was bright daylight behind him. The link kept fluttering, trying to balance the bright with the dark, leaving him a shadow in a government office or else a man haloed by light. "Your meeting went well, I hope." "It was fine," she said. "We're moving ahead with the Martian summit. They're working out the security arrangements now." "That was the consensus?" "Once I told them it was, yes. The Martians are sending their top men to a meeting with officials of the United Nations to personally deliver their apology and discuss how to normalize relations and return Ganymede to blah, blah, blah. Yes?" Ehrenreich scratched his chin. "I'm not sure that's how our opposites on Mars see it," he said. "Then they can protest. We'll send out dueling press releases and threaten to cancel the meeting right up to the last minute. High drama is wonderful. It's better than wonderful. It's distracting. Just don't let the bobblehead talk about Venus or Eros." His flinch was almost subliminal. "Please, can we not refer to the Secretary General as the bobblehead?" "Why not? He knows I do. I say it to his face and he doesn't mind." "He thinks you're joking." "That's because he's a fucking bobblehead. Don't let him talk about Venus." "And the footage?" It was a fair question. Whatever had made its attack on Ganymede, it had started in the area held by the United Nations. If the back-channel chatter was to be trusted, and it wasn't, Mars had a lone marine suit camera. Avasarala had 7 minutes of high-definition video from 40 different cameras of the thing slaughtering the best people Earth had standing for it. Even if the Martians could be convinced to keep it quiet, this was going to be hard to bury. "Give me until the meeting," Avasarala said. "Let me see what they say and how they say it. Then I'll know what to do. If it's a Martian weapon, they'll show it by what they bring to the table." "I see," Ehrenreich said slowly, meaning he didn't. "Sir, with all respect," she said, "for the time being, this needs to be something between Earth and Mars. High drama between the two major military forces in the system is what we want. How exactly do you see that?" "I got an alert from Michael John de Outre Bay about increased activity on Venus at the same time the shooting started on Ganymede. It wasn't a big spike, but it was there. And Venus getting restless just when something happens that looks a damn lot like the protomolecule showed up on Ganymede? That's a problem." She let that sink in for a moment before she went on. Ehrenreich's eyes shifted like he was reading in the air. It was something he did when he was thinking hard. "Saber rattling we've done before," she said. "We've survived it. It's a known quantity. I have a binder with 900 pages of analysis and contingency plans for conflict with Mars, including 14 different scenarios about what we do if they develop an unexpected new technology. The binder for what we do if something comes up from Venus? It's 3 pages long. And it begins, step one, find God." Ehrenreich looked sober. She could hear Soren behind her. A different and more anxious silence than he usually carried. She'd laid her fear out on the table. 3 options, she said softly. 1, Mars made it. That's just war. We can handle that. 2, someone else made it. Unpleasant and dangerous, but solvable. 3, it made itself. And we don't have anything. "You're going to put more pages in your thin binder?" Ehrenreich said. He sounded flippant. He wasn't. "No, sir, I'm going to find out which of the 3 we're looking at. If it's one of the first 2, I'll solve the problem. And if the third? Retire, she said. Let you put some other idiot in charge. Aaron Wright had known her long enough to hear the joke in her voice. He smiled and tugged absently at his tie. It was a tell of his. He was as anxious as she was. No one who didn't know him would have seen it. That's a tightrope. We can't let the conflict on Ganymede become too heated. I'll keep it a sideshow, Avasarala said. No one starts a war unless I say they can. You mean unless the Secretary General issues the executive decision and the General Assembly casts an affirming vote? And I'll tell them when he can do that, she said. But you can give him the news. Hearing it from an old grandma like me makes his dick shrink. Well, we can't have that, certainly. Let me know what you find. I'll speak with the speechwriting staff and make certain that the text of his announcement doesn't color outside the lines. And anyone who leaks the video of the attack answers to me, she said. Anyone who leaks it is guilty of treason and will be tried before a legitimate tribunal and sent to the Lunar Penal Colony for life. Close enough. Don't be a stranger, Chris Jen. We're in difficult times. The fewer surprises, the better. Yes, sir, she said. The link died. The screen went dark. She could see herself in it as a smudge of orange topped by the gray of her hair. Sorin was a blur of khaki and white. You need more work? No, ma'am. So get the fuck out. Yes, ma'am. She heard his footsteps retreating behind her. Sorin! Ma'am? Get me a list of everyone who testified at the Eros incident hearings, and run what they said in testimony past the neuropsych analysts, if it hasn't already been. Would you like the transcripts? Yes, that too. I'll have them to you as soon as possible. The door closed behind him, and Avasarala sank into her chair. Her feet hurt, and the presentiment of a headache that had haunted her since morning was stepping forward, clearing its throat. The Buddha smiled serenely, and she chuckled at him, as if sharing a private joke. She wanted to go home, to sit on her porch and listen to Arjun practice his piano. And instead, she used her hand terminal rather than the office system to call Arjun. It was a superstitious urge that made her want to keep them separate, even in ways as small as this. He picked up the connection at once. His face was angular, the close-cut beard almost entirely white now. The merriness in his eyes was always there, even when he wept. Just looking at him, she felt something in her breast relax. I'm going to be late coming home, she said, immediately regretting the matter-of-fact tone. Arjun nodded. I am shocked beyond words, he said. Even the man's sarcasm was gentle. The mask is heavy today? The mask, he called it. As if the person she was when she faced the world was the false one, and the one who spoke to him or played painting games with her granddaughters was authentic. She thought he was wrong, but the fiction was so comforting she had always played along. Today, very heavy. What are you doing now, love? Reading Cookery's thesis draft. It needs work. Are you in your office? Yes. You should go to the garden, she said. Because that's where you want to be? We can go together when you're home. She sighed. I may be very late, she said. Wake me, and we can go then. She touched the screen, and he grinned as if he'd felt the caress. She cut the connection. By long habit, they didn't tell each other goodbye. It was one of a thousand small personal idioms that grew from decades of marriage. Avasarala turned to her desk system, pulling up the tactical analysis of the battle on Ganymede, the intelligence profiles of the major military figures within Mars, and the master schedule for the meeting, already half filled in by the generals in the time since her conference. She took a pistachio from her purse, cracked its shell, and let the raw information wash over her, her mind dancing through it. In the window behind her, the other stars struggled through the light pollution of The Hague, but Venus was still the brightest.
Chapter 6. Holden. Holden was dreaming of long, twisting corridors filled with half-human horrors when a loud buzzing woke him to a pitch-black cabin. He struggled for a moment with the unfamiliar straps on the bunk before he unbuckled and floated free in the microgravity. The wall panel buzzed again. Holden pushed off the bed to it and hit the button to bring the cabin lights up. The cabin was tiny. A 70-year-old crash couch above a personal storage locker, crammed up against one bulkhead, a toilet and sink built into a corner, and across from the bunk, a wall panel with the name Somnambulist etched above it. The panel buzzed a third time. This time, Holden hit the reply button and said, "Where are we, Naomi?" "Final braking for high orbit. You're not going to believe this, but they're making us queue up." "Queue up? As in get in line?" "Yep," Naomi said. "I think they're boarding all the ships that are landing on Ganymede." Shit, he thought. Shit, which side is it? Does it matter? "Well," Holden said, "Earth wants me for stealing a couple thousand of their nuclear missiles and handing them over to the OPA. Mars just wants me for stealing one of their ships. I assume those carry different penalties." Naomi laughed. "They'd lock you up for eternity either way." "Call me pedantic, then." The group we're in line for look like UN ships, but a Martian frigate is parked right next to them, watching the proceedings. Holden gave a private prayer of thanks for letting Fred Johnson back on Tycho talk him into taking the recently repaired Somnambulist to Ganymede, rather than try to land in the Rocinante. The freighter was the least suspicious ship in the OPA fleet right now, far less likely to draw unwanted attention than their stolen Martian warship. They'd left the Rossi parked 1,000,000 kilometers away from Jupiter in a spot no one was likely to look. Alex had the ship shut down except for air recycling and passive sensors, and was probably huddled in his cabin with a space heater and a lot of blankets, waiting for their call. "Okay, I'm on my way up. Send a tight beam to Alex and let him know the situation. If we get arrested, he's to take the Rossi back to Tycho." Holden opened the locker under the bunk and pulled out a badly fitting green jumpsuit with Somnambulist stenciled on the back and the name Phillips on the front pocket. According to the ship's records, provided by the tech wizards back at Tycho, he was crewman First Class Walter Phillips, engineer and general tool pusher on the food freighter Somnambulist. He was also third in command out of a crew of three. Given his reputation in the solar system, it was thought best that Holden not have a job on the ship that would require him to speak to anyone in authority. He washed up in his tiny sink, no actual free-flowing water but a system of moist towels and soaped pads, scratching unhappily at the scraggly beard he'd been growing as part of his disguise. He'd never tried to grow one before, and was disappointed to discover that his facial hair grew in patches of varying length and curl. Amos had grown a beard as well in an act of solidarity, and now had a lush lion's mane, which he was considering keeping because it looked so good. Holden slid the used towel into its cycling chamber and pushed off toward the compartment hatch and up the crew ladder to the operations deck. Not that it was much of an ops deck. The Somnambulist was nearly 100 years old and definitely at the end of her life cycle. If they hadn't needed a throwaway ship for this mission, Fred's people would probably have just scrapped the old girl out. Her recent run-in with pirates had left her half-dead to begin with. But she'd spent the last 20 years of her life flying the Ganymede to Ceres food run, and she'd show up in the registry as a regular visitor to the Jovian moon, a ship that might plausibly arrive with relief supplies. Fred thought that with her regular arrivals at Ganymede, she might just get waved past any customs or blockades without a look. That, it seemed, had been optimistic. Naomi was belted into one of the operations stations when Holden arrived. She wore a green jumpsuit similar to his, though the name on her pocket read Estancia. She gave him a smile, then waved him over to look at her screen. "That's the group of ships that are checking everyone out before they land." "Damn," Holden said, zooming the telescopic image in to get a better look at the hulls and identifying marks. "Definitely UN ships." Something small moved across the image from one of the UN ships to the heavy freighter that was currently at the front of the line. "And that looks like a boarding skiff." "Well, good thing you haven't groomed in a month," Naomi said, tugging at a lock of his hair. "With that bush on your head and that awful beard, your own mothers wouldn't recognize you." "I'm hoping they haven't recruited my mothers," Holden said, trying to match her lightness of tone. "I'll warn Amos that they're coming." Holden, Naomi, and Amos waited in the short, locker-filled hallway just outside the inner airlock door for the boarding party to finish cycling the lock. Naomi looked tall and stern in her freshly washed captain's uniform and magnetic boots. Captain Estancia had skippered the Somnambulist for 10 years before the pirate attack that took her life. Holden thought Naomi made a suitably regal replacement. Behind her, Amos wore a jumpsuit with a chief engineer's patch and a bored scowl. Even in the microgravity of their current orbit around Ganymede, he seemed to be slouching. Holden did his best to emulate his stance and his half-angry expression. The airlock finished cycling and the inner doors slid open. 6 Marines in combat armor and a junior lieutenant in an environment suit clanked out on mag boots. The lieutenant quickly looked over the crew and checked them against something on his hand terminal. He looked as bored as Amos did. Holden guessed that this poor junior officer had been stuck with the shit duty of boarding ships all day, and was probably in as big a hurry to be done as they were to leave. "Rowena Estancia, captain and majority owner of the Ceres registered freighter Weeping Somnambulist." He didn't make it a question, but Naomi replied, "Yes, sir." "I like the name," the lieutenant said without looking up from his terminal. "Sir?" "The ship name. It's unusual. I swear if I board one more ship named after someone's kid or the girl they left behind after that magical weekend on Titan, I'm going to start fining people for general lack of creativity." Holden felt a tension begin at the base of his spine and creep up toward his scalp. This lieutenant might be bored with his job, but he was smart and perceptive, and he was letting them know it up front. "Well, this one is named after the tearful 3 months I spent on Titan after he left me," Naomi said with a grin. "Probably a good thing in the long term. I was going to name her after my goldfish." The lieutenant's head snapped up in surprise. Then he began laughing. "Thanks, Captain. That's the first laugh today. Everyone else is scared shitless of us. And these 6 slabs of meat," he gestured at the Marines behind him, "have had their senses of humor chemically removed." Holden shot a look to Amos. "Is he flirting with her?" "I think he's flirting with her." Amos's scowl could have meant anything. The lieutenant tapped something on his terminal and said, "Protein supplements, water purifiers, and antibiotics. Can I take a quick look?" "Yes, sir," Naomi said, gesturing toward the hatch. "Right this way." She left, the UN officer and 2 of the Marines in tow. The other 4 settled into alert guard poses next to the airlock. Amos elbowed Holden to get his attention, then said, "How you boys doing today?" The Marines ignored him. "I was saying to my buddy here, I was saying, I bet those fancy tin suits those boys wear bind up something awful in the crotch." Holden closed his eyes and started sending psychic messages to Amos to shut up. It didn't work. I mean, all that fancy high-tech gear strapped on everywhere, and the one thing they don't allow for is scratching your balls. Or, God forbid, you get out of alignment and gotta give the works a shift to create some space. Holden opened his eyes. The Marines were all looking at Amos now, but they hadn't moved or spoken. Holden shifted to the back corner of the room and tried to press himself into it. No one even glanced in his direction. So, Amos continued, his voice full of companionable good cheer, I got this theory, and I was hoping you boys could help me out. The closest Marine took a half step forward, but that was all. My theory is, Amos said, that to avoid that whole problem, they just go ahead and cut off all those parts that might get caught up in your suit. And it has the added benefit of reducing your temptation to diddle each other during those long cold nights on the ship. The Marine took another step, and Amos immediately took one of his own to close the distance. With his nose so close to the Marine's armored faceplate that his breath fogged the glass, Amos said, So, be straight with me, Joe. The outside of those suits, that's anatomically correct, ain't it? There was a long, tense silence that was finally broken when someone cleared his throat at the hatch and the lieutenant came into the corridor. There a problem here? Amos smiled and stepped back. Nope, just getting to know the fine men and women my tax dollars help pay for. Sergeant? The lieutenant said. The Marine stepped back. No, sir. No problem. The lieutenant turned around and shook Naomi's hand. Captain Estancia, it's been a pleasure. Our people will be radioing you with landing clearance shortly. I'm sure the people of Ganymede will be grateful for the supplies you're bringing. Happy to help, Naomi said, and gave the young officer a brilliant smile. When the UN troops had cycled back through the airlock and flown away in their skiff, Naomi let out a long breath and began massaging her cheeks. If I had to smile 1 second longer, my face was going to crack apart. Holden grabbed Amos by the sleeve. What the fuck? He said through gritted teeth. Was that all about? What? Naomi said. Amos here did just about everything he could to piss the Marines off while you were gone. I'm surprised they didn't shoot him. And then me half a second later. Amos glanced down at Holden's hand, still gripping his arm, but made no move to pull free. Cap, you're a good guy, but you'd be a shitty smuggler. What? Naomi said again. The captain here was so nervous even I started to think he was up to something. So I kept the Marines' attention until you got back, Amos said. Oh, and they can't shoot you unless you actually touch them or draw a weapon. You were a UN Navy boy, you should remember the rules. So, Holden started. So, Amos interrupted, if the lieutenant asks them about us, they'll have a story to tell about the asshole engineer who got in their faces and not the nervous guy with a patchy beard who kept trying to hide in the corner. Shit, Holden said. You're a good captain, and you can have my back in a fight any time, but you're a crap criminal. You just don't know how to act like anyone but yourself. Want to be captain again? Naomi said. That job sucks. Ganymede Tower, this is Somnambulist repeating our request for a pad assignment, Naomi said. We've been cleared by the UN patrols, and you've had us holding in low orbit for 3 hours now. Naomi flicked off her mic and added, Asshole. The voice that replied was different from the one they'd been requesting landing clearance from for the last few hours. This one was older and less annoyed. Sorry, Somnambulist, we'll get you into the pattern as soon as possible. But we've had launches non-stop for the last 10 hours, and we still have a dozen ships to get off the ground before we start letting people land. Holden turned on his mic and said, We talking to the supervisor now? Yep, Senior Supervisor Sam Snelling, if you're making notes for a complaint. That's Snelling with 2 L's. No. Holden replied. Not a complaint. We've been watching the outgoing ships flying by. Are these refugee ships? With the tonnage we've seen lifting off, it looks like half the moon is leaving. Nope, we do have a few charters and commercial liners taking people off, but most of the ships leaving right now are food freighters. Food freighters? We ship almost 100,000 kilos of food a day, and the fighting trapped a lot of those shipments on the surface. Now that the blockade is letting people through, they're on their way out to make their deliveries. Wait, Holden said. I'm waiting to land with relief food supplies for people starving on Ganymede, and you're launching 100,000 kilos of food off the moon?
Closer to 500,000, what with the backup, Sam said.
But we don't own this food. Most of the food production on Ganymede is owned by corporations that aren't headquartered here. A lot of money tied up in these shipments. Every day it sat on the ground here, people were losing a fortune.
Holden started. Then, after a pause, said, Somnambulist out.
Holden turned his chair around to face Naomi. Her expression was closed, in a way that meant she was as angry as he was. Amos, lounging near the engineering console and eating an apple he'd stolen from their relief supply, said,
This surprises you, why, Captain?
An hour later, they got permission to land. Seen from low orbit and their descent path, the surface of Ganymede didn't look much different than it ever had. Even at its best, the Jovian moon was a wasteland of gray silicate rock and slightly less gray water ice, the entire thing pocked with craters and flash-frozen lakes. It had looked like a battlefield long before humanity's ancestors crawled up onto dry land for the first time. But humans, with their great creativity and industriousness in the domain of destruction, had found ways to make their mark. Holden spotted the almost skeletal remains of a destroyer stretched across the landscape at the end of a long, black scar. The shockwave of its impact had flattened smaller domes as far as 10 kilometers away. Tiny rescue ships flitted about its corpse, looking less for survivors than for bits of information or technology that had survived the crash and couldn't be allowed to fall into enemies' hands. The worst damage visible was the complete loss of one of the enormous greenhouse domes. The agricultural domes were gigantic structures of steel and glass, with hectares of carefully cultivated soil and meticulously bred and tended crops beneath them. To see one crushed beneath the twisted metal of what looked like a fallen mirror array was shocking and demoralizing. The domes fed the outer planets with their specially bred crops. The most advanced agricultural science in history happened inside them. And the orbiting mirrors were marvels of engineering that helped make it possible. Slamming one into the other and leaving both lying in ruins struck Holden as being as stupidly short-sighted as shitting in your water supply to deny your enemy a drink. By the time the somnambulist had set her creaking bones to rest on their assigned landing pad, Holden had lost all patience with human stupidity. So, of course, it came out to meet him. The customs inspector was waiting for them when they stepped out of the airlock. He was a stick-thin man with a handsome face and an egg-shaped bald head. He was accompanied by two men in nondescript security guard uniforms with tasers and holsters at their belts.
Hello, my name is Mr. Vedas. I am the customs inspector for Port 11, pads A-14 through A-22. Your manifest, please.
Naomi, once again playing captain, stepped forward and said,